This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined as always by my good friend Bradley Chambers. Tonight we've got one sponsor for the show. This show is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one solution for making an amazing website. We'll tell you more about that as the show goes on, but for a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TABLET. Good evening, Bradley.
How's it going?
I'm okay. I'm surviving. I stayed up for some of your Super Bowl last night, and that was I felt the pain of that this morning.
Yeah, that was not a great game. That was not a great game. I don't have a dog in the fight because we live in Georgia, or we pull for Atlanta, but we live in Tennessee. And but I was, you know, rooting for the Broncos, but they it's a tough game. Tough game.
Well, my NFL knowledge is such that I was heartbroken that John Elway wasn't playing.
Well, I kept thinking that he would suit up at some point and just come out there and play.
Well, given the way that first half went, I wouldn't be surprised if that would have been better for them.
So, do you have a preference on your favorite commercial?
Well, see, we didn't get the commercials because in the UK, although we were watching essentially the Fox News broadcast or the Fox Sports broadcast, Channel 4 would cut in with their own commercials whenever Fox went to their commercials, so we don't see any of the US ones.
Yeah, the whole thing's kind of lost its luster because all the commercials are shown ahead of time on the internet and is usually a longer version of it.
Yeah, so what you see is the cut-down cheapskate version on the actual show.
Yeah, I thought Squarespace had a nice ad, and you know, GoDaddy's was the first one that didn't make me like very much hate the company. In a few years, I don't know what that, you know, I don't know that that's like setting the bar real high. But no, I thought Squarespace had a nice one. I had seen it ahead of time, and it was, I think for a lot of companies now, that a Super Bowl ad is almost like a coming out party and saying like, okay, we, you know, we're not just a startup anymore. Like we are an actual company. You know, of course, you know, obviously Apple didn't have an ad, but I don't think they need to.
Yeah. A Super Bowl ad is kind of like North Korea driving the missiles up and down the square, isn't it?
Yes.
So a little bit of a show of strength.
A company called Esurance, which is like an online insurance agency, did an interesting kind of trick. They did the first ad after the Super Bowl, and that one is like $1.5 million cheaper. And they said, you know, use the hashtag something, I think it was EsuranceSaver30, and one person will be picked to get the $1.5 million we saved. And so I started seeing that in my timeline. It's like, all right, immediately tap on that hashtag and hide forever. And that's why I love Tweetbot. Hide those things.
Tweetbot forever. Yeah, so any news to talk about?
Not that I know of. Been quiet. It's like calm before the storm.
Yeah. Did we talk about Apple's earnings last? Was that out last time we talked?
It was not. Remember.
No, so, I mean, what was it? A big pile of money and quite a lot of iPhones, you know. I suppose, you know, for our purposes, the interesting thing was that they did 26 million iPads in the last quarter, which is, I think, a record number of iPads in any quarter. And obviously, it was the Christmas quarter, so they're going to do a lot. But I think what's interesting is that Christmas quarter is really the only quarter where you can really see how Apple's programs are growing, how their devices are growing, because, you know, you look at those Christmas peaks and you start to see, are they going up or are they going down? And you can see with the iPod that they peaked a long time ago and they're starting to go down, even though the Christmas quarter is still much bigger than the other three. But the Christmas quarter this year was bigger than the Christmas quarter last year, so that's the kind of seasonality that Apple has, I guess. Back to school doesn't even make a dent in the numbers anymore, I'm afraid.
Well, and so. I think so many people, not that summer's not a big computer buying season or a big iPad buying season, but it seems like computers aren't just for school anymore. And so I don't think people would literally wait until the summer. And their back-to-school promotions aren't like so incredible that you have to wait for them.
Yeah, no, they're not giving the store away anymore on those things, are they?
I'm always interested to watch the gross margins and the average selling price of iOS devices. And I think that's all, you know, always telling. You know, the iPhone ASP has really held up fairly well over the years. And I think that shows that people are still buying the high-end phone. You know, it'll be interesting over the next, say, 12 to 24 months what the iPad does, especially now that the Mini is no longer kind of a second-class citizen device-wise in terms of power. See if that drops.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things over the past few years is we've sort of been learning what tablets are for. And I think you sort of see that as the average selling price of iPad has kind of slid and slid and slid as cheaper tablets have come in, and as, you know, it's got cheaper to make the iPad and so on, and cheaper variants have come in the line. But it'll be interesting to see just where that goes in the future.
You know,
and whether or not the issue of people maybe not spending so much on a desktop computer and spending more on their iPad when they come to buy their second iPad or the third one maybe becomes a thing.
Going back to something we've talked about many episodes is the fact that Apple's really not moved the standard size-wise in terms of storage up at all in recent years. And you wonder if that's really trying to protect their gross margins on the devices. Because, again, mm-hmm. if they, you know, I would love to see a breakout, but I would say they sell quite a few 32-gig iPads and iPhones. And I think if they move those down to where they were the standard models, you would see a lot of those people not go upgrade again to the 64-gig. I think 32-gig for a lot of people is enough. And so you have a lot of people think, all right, we're going to spend a lot. We're spending $400. Let's go ahead and spend $500 on a 32-gig and get what we need. And so, like, you just wonder if that's the discussion, is trying to hold that average selling price and the gross margins to where they're at. Because I know anytime gross margin takes a dip, people start talking about it as, you know, has Apple lost its ability to innovate and control the supply chain, you know, yada, yada, yada. But you just wonder if that's the reason.
Yeah, but then at the same time, you know, people are like, oh, the gross margins took a hit, and then they're like, oh, but Apple needs to make a cheaper product. It's like, well, which one do you want? Do you want big margin? Do you want cheaper products? Come on. You know, so I think the thing that gets me about Apple's margin is when you go to buy iPads, and you sort of say, well, you know, buying quite a few of these iPads, what kind of discount can we get? And they're like, you know, a big suck through the teeth, and it's like, oh, maybe we can get 1.5% or something, you know? And you're like, dude, you're making 30-something percent on this thing. Come on. You know, and I think that's the only kind of bit that rankles me about this, is that I think, you know, that old Steve Jobs line about they went for profits when they could have gone for market share. And I think, particularly in education, which is an incredibly price-sensitive market, I wonder if it might not be worth sacrificing a little bit of that margin in a specific vertical. I'm not just saying that because I want a cheaper iPad, but I think, you know, schools who want to buy a lot of iPads, you know, a few more extra points could potentially make the difference between them doing it and not doing it.
Yeah, I think
there's definitely room to play with it there.
I think, yeah, the average kind of discount is, if you're buying 10 at a time, you get like $10 or $20 off. And I would love to see that be, if you're buying 10 iPads at a time, give me $100 off. Give me the $499 model for $399. And yeah, basically, I would love to see a full-size iPad that's like the premier device at the time at $400, you know, for education.
Yeah.
Obviously, I'm not saying they should do that for everybody, but if you're buying in any sort of quantity, 10 plus, give me $100 off, because that's what they do on the Macs. And, you know, if you're looking at deals that could be 20 to 30,000 iPads, yeah, that's a lot of money to Apple, but that's also a lot of devices.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you are doing 20,000 to 30,000 iPads, you're engaging at such a level that you may be talking about more of a discount. But I think the thing is that for little schools, or not even little schools, but just individual schools rather than school districts or local authorities or something, I think it's hard for people at that scale to get into that kind of conversation. And I think it should be potentially made easier for a lot more people to get reasonable discounts on this kind of hardware.
Yeah, no, I would not disagree there.
Still, Apple makes all the money, as usual. But it's interesting that some of the numbers are not as... they're not growing as fast as they used to. And I think... I mean, it's not like it's the end of the world or anything like that, but I think, you know, you're starting to see a reasonable end to the number of people who can buy a smartphone at whatever price Apple wants to sell it at, you know. And obviously, I think there'll be changes pretty soon. Well, I say pretty soon, I don't know anything, but, you know, in the next cycle to open up some new angles for selling iPhones. I think in particular, there's been reports this week of a bigger iPhone coming out, which I would queue up for on day one. If it happened, I absolutely would. But I think we start to see some of that kind of stuff happening as well.
Well, you kind of saturate your current market, and you can either accept the rate of growth you're going, or you can try to open up new markets. Because, you know, it's like the problem that Facebook kind of has right now. There's only so many people that can sign up for Facebook. And there's only so many people that are going to buy the iPads and the iPhones at the current prices and current models. You know, you run into limits of economics and people.
Yeah, there's not enough people in the world to go on Facebook anymore.
So, yeah. No, it's it'll be interesting to see. I think it'll be mm-hmm. interesting really 24 months as we especially kind of get further and further into the Tim Cook era.
Yeah. So, let's not beat around the bush anymore. We've got something serious to talk about tonight, I think.
Yes.
And something really bothered me last week. And it bothered me so much that I wrote and deleted about 4 blog posts about it, because I couldn't quite figure out what it was I wanted to say, and I thought maybe we could explore this on the show. But it recently was the 30th anniversary of the Mac, and Apple made a big splash about it, which is kind of unusual for Apple if you think about it, because Apple, at least under Steve Jobs, was not a company that was in any kind of thrall to their history whatsoever. And even important events such as the introduction of both the iPhone and the iPad, Jobs only ever made fleeting reference or quick reference to the Mac, the introduction of the Mac, the introduction of the PowerBook, and so on, and quickly got on to the here and now and then the future. Whereas this past kind of fortnight, Apple has sort of wallowed in nostalgia a little bit and given us a huge big thing on the web about the 30th anniversary of the Mac and so on. Did you see much of that, Bradley?
Yeah, I browsed the website and it worked pretty well on my iOS device, and that was nice. But I think I reminded that Steve Jobs quote where he talked about not dwelling on your past successes, but move on to the next thing. And that just wasn't. It seemed very un-Steve like. Not necessarily a bad thing, but just very un-Steve like.
Yeah, and I think it's we have to bear in mind that this isn't Steve Jobs Apple anymore. You know, it's Tim Cook's Apple now, and I think some things are being done differently. Lots of things are being done differently, some for better, some possibly not for better. But what happened around about this time, as well as doing this whole big thing on their website, some Apple executives also gave an interview to Macworld, to Jason Snell at Macworld. And I know Jason, I've met him a few times, and I think he's a great journalist and does a really stand-up job of covering Apple in a way that is not insane, which is unfortunately all too rare in technology these days. But basically, Phil Schiller and Bud Tribble and Craig Federighi, who are respectively the VP of product marketing, Phil Schiller, the head of engineering, I think, Bud Tribble, one of the original Mac team guys. Craig Federighi is, of course, the executive in charge of iOS and OS X software. He was put in charge of both of those projects after Scott Forsell left the company a while ago. And the three of these guys gave this interview to Jason at Macworld. And basically, they talked about the future of the Mac. And the headline was what caught my eye. I don't know if you were as kind of stunned to see it as I was, Bradley, but the headline was, "The Mac Goes On Forever."
Yeah, and it felt like to me much the same kind of comment when Ballmer would talk about Windows Everywhere. It felt in the same vein to that to me. Not that they're saying the Mac is everywhere, but how do we know it's going to live on forever? And should it if it's not the best thing? And that. It just, again, going back to Apple has never been a company to dwell on history like this. And to say it'll go on forever, it feels odd.
It does. And it really felt weird to me. And of course, I've been very interested in this whole concept of the post-PC era, or taking an iPad and pushing it as hard as it can to take as much of my computing tasks as it can, and so on. I've been interested in that since the first minute I saw the iPad, and I've pushed it probably as hard as almost anybody has pushed the iPad in terms of trying to move their computer life over onto that kind of device. But let me just read you some of the quotes from this interview, right? I've pulled out what I think are kind of the 4 key points that I wanted to discuss tonight, Bradley, about what they said about the Mac, right? So Phil Schiller kicks off, and he says, "We don't waste time thinking, but it should be one interface. How do you make these operating systems merge together? What a waste of energy that would be." So first of all, he's saying we're not going to merge. He's essentially repudiating the Windows 8 strategy there, where he says that we are not going to do a Windows 8 where it's the same operating system, the same user interface on both a laptop and a tablet and a smartphone. Okay? I mean, fair enough. That's the current strategy, and that's fine. But then later it says, to say OS X and iOS should be the same, independent of their purpose, let's just converge for the sake of convergence, is absolutely a non-goal. And I haven't made it in my notes, but I think it's Craig Federighi who says that point. And then Federighi does come in. He says, we have a common sense of aesthetics, a common set of principles that drive us, and we're building the best products we can for the unique purposes. So you'll see them be the same where that makes sense, and you'll see them be different in those things that are critical to their essence. And I think what he's basically talking about there is the idea that we're not putting touchscreen on a Mac. And that's fine. But then the coup de grace, if you like, the key point to, for me in the whole interview, is when Phil Schiller says this. He says, it's not an either or. It's a world where you're going to have a phone, a tablet, a computer. You don't have to choose. And so what's more important is how you seamlessly move between them all. It's not like this is a laptop person and that's a tablet person. It doesn't have to be that way. That stopped me in my tracks. Don't know how you felt about that, Bradley.
I'm of the mindset that an iPad is a computer. Mm-hmm. And so the distinction there all these years about after we've been pushing so hard to make the iPad a computing device for real work, not just Netflix watching, but like really doing work on it. Not because for the sake of it, because of all the flexibility it brings. And to still hear it kind of separated that way feels odd to me, because I look at it as I have a smartphone, and then you have general computing devices. And the only reason why the smartphone is different is because it can make cellular telephone calls.
Yeah, and I think many people have said that one of the things that put the iPhone separate from other phones was the fact that it essentially was a computer that could make phone calls, that it wasn't just a phone with some apps on it, like a Trail or a, you know, one of the other, a BlackBerry or something like that. The iPhone is essentially a computer, but it has a phone, kind of with the phone hardware at either end. And I think that's key to sort of this central debate here, is whether or not these things are computers. And I certainly come down on the same side as you, Bradley, that I believe, I don't regard a tablet as being descriptive of anything other than the shape of the physical device. You know, some people say, well, you know, using a tablet in school or using a tablet for your work, well, you know, what does that really mean? You know, in what way is it different from using a laptop? Well, it's a different shape. I type on the screen. I don't type on a plastic attachment to the screen. But is it meaningfully different? Certainly there are some big changes to it, but, you know, what do you think?
Well, and so, I don't know, this is kind of random, but we have a friend of our school. He's helped us with many construction projects over the years, building tables, and he's a 94-year-old man. And he called me and asked if I'd come over to help him with his Windows computer. And so I walked over there, and he has broadband, but he still uses AOL. And, like, he cycles to AOL and browses the web through AOL. And although, like, we would find that comical, to him, that's the internet. Mm-hmm. That's his internet. And so if we really break down what do we do on quote-unquote computers, we accomplish tasks. They're just tools to accomplish tasks in hopefully faster, better ways. And so if some, you know, had a, our receptionist asked me earlier, she said, Bradley, I want to get a new laptop. Like, what would you suggest that I get? And I said, well, tell me what you want to do. Well, I just want to check email, I want to browse the web, and I just want to get on Facebook. I said, you absolutely should just get an iPad. Like, there's nothing new. I mean, that's the perfect laptop for you is the iPad. And because it all comes down to goals you want to accomplish. And I think so often we tried to start with the device and say, no, let's start with our goals. What are you trying to do? What are your goals here? And that's where technology, all forms of technology, whether it be a Roku, an Apple TV, a CCTV system, an iPad, a Chromebook, they all just help us accomplish our goals. And so when we try to pigeonhole these devices into different kind of subsets, like, oh, this is for real work, this is for the compute, this, you need a computer for this. Well, to me, if there's something that requires my quote-unquote computer that I can't do on my iPad, that's not a failure of the iPad. That just means, like, it hasn't grown up enough yet. Maybe I don't have the right, the software I need doesn't exist on the iPad. It's just, they're not that different. It's just a different interface. Maybe it's a slightly different interface. Obviously a slightly different OS. But what's different? Like, if you're using your laptop to watch Netflix, is it any different than watching Netflix on your Apple TV or on your iPad?
I have to say, not really.
Yeah, it's,
you know, I don't think so.
It's a movie player at that point. So mm-hmm. It becomes what you need it to be. And so
what you're talking about there is you're starting to debate the fine details of how you hold the device or how it sits in your lap or whatever. But that's, you know, there are certainly some tasks where you can take what you do in a laptop and do it on a tablet. And because it is essentially a full screen experience, you're getting more or less the same thing. I mean, scale up a little bit and say, how is it meaningfully different to use iPhoto full screen on a MacBook Air versus using iPhoto on iOS full screen on an iPad? Is it a meaningfully different task? Is there more power? Certainly there are some features that are missing either way, but is it really a different thing?
Well,
because I'm touching it? It feels a little different, but not much.
And I'm not going to use the car versus truck analogy, but let's talk about a motorcycle. You're still, is it different in some ways than driving a car? Sure. But your ultimate goal is still the same. You're getting from point A to point B. And it's, mm-hmm. I don't like motorcycles, but if someone likes motorcycles, there are inherent advantages to that. Like, you can weave in and out of traffic, and again, it's not my thing, but they're still driving. It's still transportation. Just as an mm-hmm. iPad is still computing. To try to pigeonhole them doesn't make sense to me, because you have to get back to the fundamental aspects of what are we trying to do with this technology, because we don't use technology in schools and in our workplaces for the sake of it. We use it because it helps us to do work faster and do work better. And it doesn't matter what technology it is.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And I think if we dig down a little bit deeper into this, Bradley, you know, what are the differences today? Let's just break this down. What are the differences today between iOS and OS X? Right? Let me lay some of them out to you. OS X has overlapping windows. iOS doesn't. Right? You can put two windows of two different apps side by side in OS X. You can't on iOS. You can open a file without copying. You can open a file in two different apps on OS X, whereas in iOS, you have to copy from one app sandbox to the other. There's more scripting integration on iOS on OS X. Sorry, there's less on iOS, but you know, scripting is clearly something on the Mac that's becoming less and less of a critical feature for the vast majority of people who use it. Obviously, with OS X, you're using a mouse and keyboard. With iOS, you're using touch. Yeah.
Well,
but
no,
beyond that,
don't forget about the screensaver. The iPad does not have screensavers.
Screensavers.
Big deal. Big deal.
Indeed. But beyond that, there are all kinds of things that you cannot do on your iPad simply because somebody hasn't written the code to make it happen, right? So here's the classic example. One thing that always, always, always drives me back to my Mac, which is I need to download a file from one website and upload it to another website. Is there any reason in this world why that shouldn't be achievable on iOS? No. And I want to, we'll talk about this in a little bit, but when iOS 5 came out, Scott Forstall explicitly said, we went through iOS and we asked our customers and we asked ourselves, why do people go back to the Mac? And we got a list of reasons why for all the little things they had to do, and we put them all on iOS. So we'll come back to that point in a minute, but there has at least once in the history of iOS been an exercise where Apple asked themselves, and possibly customers too, why do you have to go back and use your Mac for this? And they got a list of features that were missing from iOS software, and they put them in there. Right? Apart from those fundamental architectural differences of being one app or being multiple apps, side by side, overlapping windows or not, what is essentially the situation right now is there's just a whole bunch of things that haven't been implemented yet that should be implemented on iOS to bring it up even closer to the capability of the Mac. Full stop on that point. Do you want to add anything to that?
No, I wholeheartedly agree. I mean, you think about your Mac, and if you if you had to remove, you know, let's say this podcast, for example, if we had to remove GarageBand and Skype and Adobe Audition, how could we record a podcast on a Mac? You couldn't. You need software.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at this platform, it's 3 years old, or four, you know, 3.5 years old at this point. You know, think about how far we've come in just a few short years,
mm-hmm.
versus how long it took the Mac to get where it is. So it's like comparing, it, in some ways, like, I don't want to say an adult because the Mac's 30 years old, but like it's like comparing a teenager playing baseball to somebody maybe playing T-ball. It's like, yeah. In some ways, they're hard to compare. When you're trying to nitpick details, it's hard to compare. Like, you know, you can't like put a teenager pitching to somebody playing T-ball and say, well, obviously this teenager is so much better than this person. Well, mm-hmm. it's you can't really compare them because they're not the same age. They haven't had the same, you know, time to be implemented. You give, you know, if you stop that teenager from growing, you say, all right, you're going to stay at your skill level right here, your age, and we're going to let the smaller kid catch up to you. The smaller kid could easily be just as better as he gets older and gets more development.
Yeah, to stretch that analogy a little bit further, while you can't, you know, you can't take a kid out of the minor leagues and put him up beside the New York Yankees and say, well, let's see who can score the most runs here. What you can see is that kid's got a lot of potential. And you can spot that quite early. But my question remains, why would Apple executives come out and say the Mac goes on forever? Because if you think about what they said in that interview, they essentially threw out the playbook on what Steve Jobs called the post-PC era, right? Let me repeat to you Phil Schiller's quote in that article. He says, let me find it in my notes, he says, it's not an either-or. It's a world where you're going to have a phone, a tablet, a computer, you don't have to choose. And so what's more important is how you seamlessly move between them all. It's not like this is a laptop person and that's a tablet person. It doesn't have to be that way. That's what he said. He said, the future is you will have three devices and you will be able to move between them seamlessly. Now, in some ways, that's not even the future. That's the present. That's where we live today. That's why iCloud was so important. But it seems weird to me that where we thought Apple was going with iOS was, it always seemed to me kind of evident that iOS would eventually grow to match and then presumably eclipse the Mac simply because of its volume. I mean, we talked about the sales numbers from last quarter. 51 million iPhones, 26 million iPads, 4.5 million Macs. And yet here's Phil Schiller telling us that this 4.5 million rump of their product line, if you like, is going to be absolutely essential for all Apple customers for all time to come. That seems odd to me. That seems really strange. So what I wanted to do, Brad, is I wanted to try and go back in history and look a little bit at Apple's strategy over the years and try and see, well where did they come from? Where were they going to? How did they get to the places they said they were going to? And then what did Steve Jobs say about the way that this world is going, or the way that he saw Apple in the future? Now, I'm not enthralled to Steve Jobs. I don't think that Jobs was always right and nobody else can ever be right for the future. But what I do want to argue with this show is that Jobs had set a very clear course, and it feels to me like Apple just completely reversed that course. Can we try that?
Yeah. Before we move on, let's take a moment to thank this week's sponsor, for Out of School. As Fraser mentioned at the top of the show, this episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TABLET when you check out. Again, that's TABLET, T-A-B-L-E-T. Squarespace is constantly improving their platform with new features, new designs, and even better support. They have beautiful designs for you to start with and all the style options you need to create a unique website for you or your business. Very easy to customize it. They have over 20 templates that are all responsive, so that means they look great on any device, whether it's an iPhone, an iPad, or a desktop computer. Again, it's incredibly easy to use. But if you do need some help, they have an amazing support team that's there 24/7. They're all in New York, and their office has been nicknamed the Care Bear Layer because they are that good. The customer support team has won numerous awards. It costs just $8 a month, and if you pay for a year in advance, it includes a free domain name. So that's like saving $10 right there. Again, as we mentioned, every design is automatically responsive, has a unique mobile experience. And it's not just the same mobile experience for every theme. Every theme and every template has its own unique mobile experience. So again, you've got no reason not to try it. No credit card required for a free offer. Go to squarespace.com, use the offer code tablet for 10% off. That lets them know you came from our show. And so we want to thank them for sponsoring Out of School this week. Again, Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website.
Okay, thanks to Squarespace for sponsoring the show. Definitely.
Yeah.
So, what I wanted to do was to try and go back to 1996-97 and think about the second Steve Jobs era at Apple. And I want to make an argument that Steve Jobs, I hesitate to say the word lied, but certainly, let's say, dissembled about strategy from time to time. Or at least, what I want to say is he dissembled about when products were right for the market and when they were not. But what I do want to argue is that he never dissembled about what Apple's strategy was. He was always crystal clear about that, very open about it at the start, and achieved almost every strategy that he set out to do. So let me take you back to 1997. Okay? Apple's in a lot of trouble. Apple's practically bankrupt. Jobs comes back, and it's WWDC 1997. And you can see all these clips on YouTube. We're going to drop in a few audio clips just now just to give you an idea of what Steve said in public and talk about that kind of strategy. So in 1997, he's taking a lot of questions from the crowd, which is something they didn't do in later years. And somebody asks him, you know, could you talk a little bit about the future? And this is part of what he replies.
Much of the great leverage of using computers these days is using them not just for computationally intensive tasks, but using them as a window into communication intensive tasks, as you know. And never have I seen something more powerful than this computation combined with this network technology that we now have. So not only networks throughout an organization, but of course the wide area networks through the internet. And I just want to focus on something that's very close to my heart, which is living in a high-speed networked world to get your job done every day. Now, how many of you manage your own storage on your computers? How many of you back up your computers, as an example? How many of you have had a crash in the last, you know, 3 years, 4 years? Right. Okay, let me describe the world I live in. About 8 years ago, we had high-speed networking connected to our now obsolete Next hardware, running NextStep at the time. And because we were using NFS, we were able to take all of our personal data, our home directories we call them, off of our local machines and put them on a server. And the software made that completely transparent, and because the server had a lot of RAM on it, in some cases it was actually faster to get stuff from the server than it was to get stuff off your local hard disk, because in some cases it would be cached in the RAM of the server if it was in popular use. But what was really remarkable was that the organization could hire a professional person to back up that server every night, and could afford to spend a little bit more on that server, so maybe it had redundant disk drives, redundant power supplies. And you know, in the last 7 years, you know how many times I have lost any personal data? Zero. Do you know how many times I've backed up my computer? Zero. I have computers at Apple, at Next, at Pixar, and at home. I walk up to any of them and log in as myself. It goes over the network, finds my home directory on the server, and it just is, I've got my stuff wherever I am. Wherever I am. And none of that is on a local hard disk. Now, what's really interesting to me is that gigabit Ethernet's coming. With gigabit Ethernet, it is faster in every case to talk to the server than it is my local hard disk. And one of the things I'm really excited about is to look at that personal computer and take out every moving part except the keyboard and the mouse. I don't need a hard disk in my computer if I can get to the server faster. See, because I look at that network connection as NFS dial tone. I get internet dial tone and NFS dial tone over that wire. And I don't care how it's done. I don't care what box is at the other end. We happen to use an AUSPEX at Next, right? Big one. Spent $500,000 on it. It was worth it. We did a lot of software development. Nobody ever lost anything. Nobody had to worry about that stuff. But you could have smaller ones. But managing a network like this is a pain in the butt. Setting it up, getting it all to work is really complicated. One of my hopes is that Apple can do for this new type of network, it's not so new, but for the average person it's new, with gigabit Ethernet technologies and some of the new server stuff that's coming down the pike, and some thinner hardware clients that are thinner, not necessarily software, that Apple could make that as plug and play for mere mortals as it made the user experience over a decade ago.
So in that clip, I think what you see there is Jobs clearly sees a world where computers and the internet kind of get a lot closer tied together. You know, he talks about computers being connected to big servers, first of all, for backup and things like that. But then, you know, computers with no state on them, which is kind of interesting because we didn't quite get to that part. That was a very early kind of strategy. But a lot of the stuff that he talks about in that, you know, we can imagine today. So for example, you know, how do we back up our iPad? Well, we back it up to iCloud and somebody deals with iCloud. We don't lose any data when we do that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. You're not having to go plug it into anything and then manage that backup and make sure it works. It's just there. You don't have to think about it. And I guess that clip to me, if I had to sum it up with one word, is that he sees the future of like managing your data to be effortlessly, that it's just there and it's expected to be there.
Yeah. And in some ways, that's sort of where we get to, you know, implementation differences aside, we sort of get to that with something like iCloud in the future. But what's interesting about that is if you think about when Apple, in 1987, where was Apple? Well, Apple didn't have much of an internet strategy at that point. But I think what Steve is bringing to the company at that point was he was saying, networks are going to be huge. And I think that was clear in the strategy that followed, that we got the iMac, the very letter I stood for internet, connected to the network, very network capable, you know, had built in modem, built in Ethernet, all those things that you wouldn't normally have got at that time on a consumer computer, put them all in there so you could just connect to the network trivially easily. So that's point number one. Point number two is that when Steve came back to Apple, he famously killed off so many products that they were literally picketing outside Cupertino, particularly about the Newton specifically, but also about other products. And Steve came out very clearly and he said, you know, there's going to be this four-box strategy for products. There's going to be pro and consumer, desktop and laptop, which gave us the iMac, the iBook, the Power Mac, and the PowerBook. Right? Book meaning laptop, Mac meaning desktop. And that was crystal clear. And they executed that, and that was the strategy for a long time until, I guess, what came next, Bradley? G4 Cube?
Yeah, I guess that was.
Is that first thing to disrupt that?
Yeah, I guess that was the G4 Cube. I'm trying to think back, because that was pre my days of an Apple user, but I think that would have had to have been the next thing. I guess you can even say that's kind of a precursor to the Mac Mini.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much the spiritual successor to that. So today we have a slightly different matrix. You know, for a while there we had MacBooks, MacBook Airs, and MacBook Pro, and we had Mac Pro, and iMac, and Mac Mini. So it was more a kind of 3x2 sort of thing, but still, you know, that simple strategy does sort of continue almost to this day.
Well, and if you, I think that's so important. You know, Steve's vision of what makes a good computer is it's not just aimed at the people that are writing software. Like it's you know, not just as like cars are not aimed at just like at mechanics. They're aimed to be a tool for everybody. And so Steve's vision was to make it not as weak as possible, but as simple as possible. You know, obviously with enough power for that, that devices can scale up with you as you need them, but that the average person should be able to pick up something and make it work. Just as like if you've never driven, you know, a car, like if you've never driven like this kind of car, you should be able to like get in there and drive it, and it should just be pretty simple. And so just the same way like a refrigerator, you can figure out how to operate that. Like you open it up and put stuff in there. That was Steve's vision, is that technology would be integrated into our lives and not a source of frustration, but a source of enablement.
Yeah, there's a great clip from Jobs from, I think, 1978, which is the year I was born, bizarrely, where he says, he's talking to some group, I don't know who he's talking to, but he says, you know, when you want to use a computer to solve your problem, we put this massive obstacle in your way, which is you've got to first learn to use the computer, and then you've got to solve your problem. And what he said they were going to do with the Mac was they were going to take that away and make it so you could use a computer to solve the problem directly. I think, you know, for the time, he's sort of roughly talking about you don't have to write a program to solve your problem. You can just use some existing software to solve your problem. But so this is 1997, 98. The iMac comes out, is a huge hit. And then the next question is, well, what's Apple doing for an operating system? Because at that time, they were running Mac OS 8, Mac OS 9, the old, you know, System 7 based OS. And for years and years before that, there had been this fits and starts attempt to create a quote unquote modern operating system for the Mac. They had tried with, you know, the Taligent project, they tried with Copeland, they'd failed a couple of times. And when Steve comes back to Apple, obviously he comes back as part of the merger with Next, or the acquisition of Next rather, and the new OS strategy is called Rhapsody. Okay, which is essentially next step with a macOS compatibility layer, and that's going to be the next system. What happens there is that the big developers, particularly Adobe and Microsoft, but also others, who had written software for the traditional Mac, said, no, we don't want to run in an emulation environment. We want full API compatibility natively on the operating system for our applications. So what happens then in 2000... is that they sort of change tack a little bit and they say, okay, we're going to invent this thing called Carbon. Carbon is going to be most of the traditional Mac toolbox brought over onto essentially the next step kernel and platform, and you'll be able to run a carbonized version of Photoshop and Office directly on OS X. And OS X ships in 2001. And that strategy, you know, Cocoa, the old next step APIs, plus Carbon, was a very consistent strategy from 2001 all the way through to when Carbon was essentially deprecated, the Mac toolbox was deprecated with, I think, 10.8. So very, very consistent operating system strategy for years and years and years, all the way through from 01 all the way through to when essentially everything had to be Cocoa at some level once the Carbon stuff was essentially deprecated in 2010, 2011, something like that. So again, a very consistent operating system strategy in that whole time. Along the way there, of course, Jobs said many things about what people wanted and what they didn't. But he never said, well, we're doing this thing, and then did something else. Can you sort of see the consistency that's coming through with what I'm seeing here?
Yeah, and I think these kind of talks from Steve are in some ways what I miss about him most. I mean, we obviously all miss him, and obviously not that we were his friends or his family, but that we admired his work. And you know, those kind of future gazing talks from Steve about, you know, this is how it'll be 10 years from now, were just so wonderful. And that's why I've gone back and listened to like the D3 and D4 talks many times, because it was so interesting to see, you know, in some ways how he was dead on, and in some ways how he was wrong. But it's just, guys, that's, I think, what we're missing without him.
Yeah. And I think there are other examples to go on. I mean, the next one is, you know, OS X ships in 2001. In 2002, Jobs comes out and he says, look, there's another strategy coming on here. People are saying the PC's dead. You know, it's funny to think we're having this conversation now. And back in 2002, he was saying, well, people have said the PC is dying. What's going to happen? But I just want to run another audio clip here of what he says about what Apple eventually called the digital hub strategy for the Mac.
What's going to happen to the PC? We think the PC is on the threshold of entering its third great age. And that age is the age of digital lifestyle. And that's being driven by an explosion of new digital devices. We have cell phones everywhere. We have portable music players, CDs, and their cousins, the new solid-state MP3 players now, everywhere. We have digital camcorders everywhere. We have DVD players exploding in consumers' homes and in business as well, even portable DVD players. Digital cameras now constitute 15% of all cameras sold in the U.S. 15%. It'll be 50% in a few years. And handheld organizers are everywhere as well. We are living in a new digital lifestyle with an explosion of digital devices. It's huge. And we believe the PC, or more importantly, the Mac, can become the digital hub of our new emerging digital lifestyle, with the ability to add tremendous value to these other digital devices. Digital hub, key phrase. Now, how can the PC add such value? Why? Well, for a few reasons. One, because it can run complex applications. These devices can't. They don't have enough horsepower. Two, because the PC's got a big screen on it. That doesn't just mean you can see more information. It means we can make much better user interfaces. Most of these digital devices have pretty brain-dead UIs. We can burn disks, as we've seen with CDs and now DVDs. The digital devices can't do that. And we have large, inexpensive storage. If you've ever gone out and paid a fortune for one of these little flash cards for your camera, you know what I mean. These are some of the things the PC can contribute. It also gets on the internet every way at every speed. Very few of our digital devices get on the internet at all, and those that do are slow. And so this is why we believe the PC will be the hub, not just adding value to each of these devices, but interconnecting them as well, as a digital hub. Now, we first began to understand this with the camcorder, because we invented an application called iMovie that added tremendous value to a camcorder. If you've used iMovie, it makes your digital camcorder worth 10 times as much, because you can convert raw footage into an incredible movie with transitions, cross-dissolves, credits, soundtracks. You can convert raw footage that you'd normally never look at again on your camcorder into an incredibly emotional piece of communication. Professional, personal. It's amazing. You can even then take that iMovie and send it out over a Mac to Apple's website, and we'll host it for you and stream it to any PC in the world. You can't do that with a camcorder. And we saw that the benefit here was a combination of a bunch of things. It was hardware, the computer and other hardware, the operating system, the application, the internet, and marketing to create this solution. In the case of iMovie, it was not only the Mac, but FireWire that allowed us to bring in the digital video with pristine quality. It was QuickTime in the OS and the codecs and some real-time stuff. It was iMovie, a major application. On the internet, it was the internet itself plus Apple's homepage application, which lets you build a homepage to stream your movie on in 5 minutes. And a lot of marketing to create the solution of desktop movies. So we thought this was very important, and it took all these components, and we realized that Apple is uniquely suited to do this because we're the last company in this business that has all these components under one roof. We think it's a unique strength. And we discovered this with iMovie too, that it could make a digital device called the camcorder worth 10 times as much, as 10 times more valuable to you. So, our vision. We don't think the PC's dying. We think it's evolving. It's gone from the prehistoric times to its first golden age of productivity, to its second golden age, the internet age, now entering its third golden age, the digital lifestyle age, where it will become the digital hub of these amazing new digital devices. And it will become the digital hub because it can do things that these digital devices just can't do. Run complex applications like iMovie, iTunes, iDVD. Big screen for the user interfaces we need to do these things and to make it simple to burn discs, CDs, and now DVDs, and large inexpensive storage. And it can talk to the internet any way, any speed. We think this is going to be huge. And the glue that's going to make all this happen are the applications. And we are working on even more. iMovie, iTunes, iDVD. They are going to be our passport into this new digital lifestyle era. And that is where we are going.
So I think what's interesting about that clip, Bradley, is that that was a strategy. At the time, they only had a couple of parts of it. They had iTunes, and I think they had iMovie and iDVD, but they didn't have the other bits. And he just comes out and says, guys, we're going to do this. And then they spent the next, 4 years building it all out? Building GarageBand, building iWeb, building iPhoto, you know, crucial part of the whole ecosystem. And that was a strategy. They said, we're going to do this. They just went ahead and did it.
And, you know, and of course, in 2001, we got the original iPod, but then you start seeing that fruition come with handheld devices with the iPod Photo. I mean, again, that wasn't the... Mm-hmm. Was that the premium photo viewing device? Absolutely not. But you can see, you looking back, connecting the dots, how it was... That was the idea, you know, we kind of take for granted now that I can take my photos with me in my pocket. But at the time, we didn't have anything like that.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was... It was that, or I don't even know if we had digital photo frames back then, but, you know, there wasn't that many other things going around. 2004, which is when the iPod Photo came out. So I think it remains kind of interesting that that was a strategy. They went ahead and did it. You know, they put what they had in the middle, and then they started to eat up bits around it, you know. Now, obviously, Apple haven't done... Well, I'd say they haven't done a camcorder and they haven't done a digital camera, but of course they have. It's called the iPhone. Right? But they started with the iPod. The iPod was obviously the beginnings of a consumer electronics strategy for Apple as well, although they weren't so crystal clear about that one at the time. So time moves on, Bradley, and the next thing that happens is, of course, the iPhone comes out, right? The 2002 to 2007, you know, they're building out this digital hub strategy. They're building iLife and iWork. The Mac's growing and growing and growing, bringing out great new releases of OS X over that period. But then the iPhone happens. And that is, I think, probably the watershed moment of, you know, technology in my lifetime. I suppose I was alive for the Mac to come out, but, you know, I was only 7 at the time, so I wasn't really paying attention. And, of course, it happened in America, so we didn't know what America was back then. At least not in as close detail as we know today. So, you know, news eventually filters across the Atlantic and stuff like that, this thing called the Mac and blah, blah, blah. And I grew up enough to find out about it later on. But I think the iPhone changes everything, doesn't it?
Yeah, I definitely agree. And if you don't listen to The Prompt, they had a great, probably 2.5 hour long episode where they dissected the original keynote. We'll drop a link into the show notes that you would, you know, obviously... I'm sure most of our listeners have watched that, but it's kind of a great, I don't want to say commentary on it, but I guess that's probably the, you know, not a director's commentary, but a fan commentary and an analyst commentary. But you can see if everything from, like, say, the digital hub speech until 2007 was Apple, like, kind of creaking the door open ever so slightly on this strategy of what the future would be, that's when they kicked the door down. And you start to really see their vision long term. You can, you know, they're just giving us bits and pieces. Okay, get your photos in your pocket. Well, we've got this DVD editing software, and we can take your camcorder movies and you can edit those very, very easily. And then you kind of get that glimpse of, okay, here's the future, and it's like incredible devices wherever you are.
Yeah, and if you think about the early days of the iPhone, so many of the things that you did with the iPhone were dependent on having done these things with iLife on the Mac first. So, for example, having all your music in iTunes meant that you could immediately bring your iPhone home and fill it with music. Having all your photos in iPhoto meant you could bring your iPhone home and sync your photos to it and view them on your iPhone. See? So there's a very direct connection there between the idea of having the digital hub and then the iPhone coming in as the sort of the Uber device that actually subsumes a large number of these other devices that Steve originally put around the spokes of the hub, if you like. You know, it was a camcorder, it was a camera, a digital camera, a CD player, you know, all these different kinds of things, a DVD player. You could do all of those things on your iPhone. So very quickly, the digital hub started to sort of become your Mac and your iPhone, and that's it, you know. And that's very interesting, kind of beginning of this, what we started to perceive as a shift towards post-PC devices. Now, at D5, you mentioned the D conference, Bradley. At D5 in 2007, that was the famous one with Steve Jobs and Bill Gates together, which was kind of a historic interview in itself. He specifically calls it the iPod as the first post-PC device. Do you remember when the iPod had, like, you could sync your address book to your iPod?
Mm-hmm.
Remember those features?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was sort of like, you know, Apple's baby steps into making a PDA of some kind. Those were good times.
I think you could do, could you do your calendar too?
I think you could eventually, yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
Over, remember iSync? That was a, I mean, it's like the thing, they had an app like that built to sync, you know, syncing, you know, contacts to the Razor and things like that. I mean, it just kind of shows you how far we've come.
Yeah, you could sync 10 songs to your Motorola rocker or wherever it was.
Ah, terrible.
Remember that phone?
Yeah, terrible.
Oh, it was terrible.
I mean, especially in hindsight, that was just a terrible phone. Yeah, it's just still, you know, still at that time, the Mac, I don't want to call it the center of your, because it's, again, you're right, it's then about the Mac and the iPhone, but the Mac is home base. You have to come in and you have to check in there. It's like capture the flag. You're bringing the flag home.
Yep. And that persisted, right? That persisted until, I suppose, I think it's probably fair to say, the Mac was still the center of your life until 2011. I'll talk about what happened in 2011 in a minute. But obviously the iPhone was a major strategy, and it wasn't even just a strategy. It was just like, this is a thing, get on board, basically. You know, that was the kind of call to the industry, I suppose. But then the next thing that happens is the iPad comes out, right? 2007 iPhone, 2010 iPad. And Jobs kind of sets up the iPad in the original introduction. He sort of sets it up as a sort of better at some key tasks, is the phrase he uses. So it has to be better at browsing the web and looking at your photos and video and email and games and things like that. But later on in that year, and this is, you know, one of my favorite interviews, is when he goes to D8, the D conference number 8. And this is the famous cars v trucks analogy. So let me just run this clip just now, because I want to hear it in his own words.
So let's talk more broadly about tablets. A second ago you said you have a lot of plans for tablets, or thoughts about what tablets could be. And when you did your presentation on the iPad, you said it's like, you know, here's your phone, here's your laptop, here's this third category. And if it's not better than a netbook, if it's not of value to people, it's not going to succeed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in my own review, I was, you know, I liked it. I was favorable. I said it had a chance to really change things. But I also said people have to feel like it's not an extra thing to carry. They have to feel like it's enough of the time going to replace enough of the things they do on their laptop, not necessarily 100%. Mm-hmm. Is the tablet going to be eventually replace the laptop, do you think? There are a lot of people who say, well, you'll never do content creation on it, for instance. Talk about what you think, where it's going. Not just the iPad, but the tablet itself as a form factor.
You know, I'm trying to think of a good analogy. When we were an agrarian nation, all cars were trucks, because that's what you needed on the farm. But as vehicles started to be used in the urban centers and America started to move into those urban and then suburban centers, cars got more popular, and innovations like automatic transmission and power steering and things that you didn't care about in a truck as much
started to become paramount in cars. And now, probably, I don't know what the statistics are, maybe one out of every 25 vehicles, 30 vehicles is a truck, where it used to be 100%. PCs are going to be like trucks. They're still going to be around. They're still going to have a lot of value, but they're going to be used by one out of X people.
And when you say PC, just so I'm clear, it's not PC versus Mac. You mean?
I mean personal computers,
and you're including laptops and desktops.
Yeah.
Okay.
And this transformation is going to make some people uneasy. People from the PC world, like you and me. It's going to make us uneasy because the PC's taken us a long ways. It's brilliant. And we like to talk about the post-PC era, but when it really starts to happen, I think it's uncomfortable for a lot of people. And because it's change, and a lot of vested interests are going to change, and it's going to be different. So I think that we're embarked on that. Is it the iPad? Who knows? Will it happen next year, or 5 years from now, or 7 years from now? Who knows? But I think we're heading in that direction.
Well, you don't really think it's going to happen next year, right? I mean, it's a longer process than that, isn't it?
Sure.
And what do you imagine? When you talk about adding power transmission and windshield wiper, like intermittent windshield wipers, are there some things you're seeing now that you think will from right now where the iPad started? Do you see anything emerging as important?
People laugh at me because I have used the phrase magical to describe the iPad.
Yes, they do.
But it's what I really think. And there is something magical about it. It's like you have a much more direct and intimate relationship with the internet and media, your apps, your content. Mm-hmm. It's like some intermediate thing has been removed and stripped away.
Well, the keyboard.
You know, like that Claritin commercial where they strip away the film?
Yeah.
It's like that.
Okay.
And it's, is it the direct action? Is it the fact that you can move it all around? Is it the fact that you have no cables and 10-hour battery life? I don't know. It's all these things plus other things which I don't understand yet. But there's something about it that's magical. And I think we are just scratching the surface on the kind of apps we can build for it. Mm-hmm. I think one can create a lot of content on a tablet.
Can we talk about that for a second?
Sure.
What do you mean? Now, you shipped it, coincidentally, or the day you shipped it, you also announced iWork redone for touch.
Sure.
$10 a piece. Those are content creation.
They are.
At least editing, but you can create from scratch there. There are a few other companies I noticed today. I got a press release that one of the Documents to Go, which has been around a long time on phones, is now out on the iPad, and it can do, or it's about to be out on the iPad, and it can do Word docs, Excel, PowerPoint, whatever. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of people who don't believe that this class of devices, because of the typing and all that, is right for content creation. Uh-huh. You obviously seem to disagree, and I'd just love for you to talk about that a little bit.
I guess why wouldn't they be is the question. You could say, when I'm going to write that 35-page analyst report, I want to use my Bluetooth keyboard. But that's 1% of the time I'm using it. So I still get the benefits the other 99% of the time. If you would say, well, the software is not powerful enough, that's just a matter of time. So it can't be that the software is not powerful enough because that can get fixed over time. So I think your vision would have to be fairly short to say that these things can't, over time, grow into tools that can do many things.
Such as, give us an example of what you would imagine would be something.
Obviously the productivity stuff, but things like editing video, things like graphic arts, things like music. You can imagine all of these content creation things on such devices.
Does some of that depend on more powerful processors and so forth?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, time takes care of lots of this stuff.
Bradley, that's one of my favorite Steve Jobs lines of all time. Because to me, that was the point where he realized what he had at his fingertips, if you like. What do you think about that?
I remember watching the transcript or reading the transcripts of that as it was happening. And you kind of read that and you kind of let it resonate. And then I wondered, did he come up with that just now, or did he have that analogy ahead of time? Because in some ways it was so perfect. And to me, in a lot of ways, it still is.
Yeah. I mean, when he says, you know, in that conception of the post-PC world, right, he doesn't say PCs are dead, right? He very clearly says PCs are going to be like trucks. They're still going to be around. They're still going to have a lot of value, but they're going to be used by one out of X people. Now, that is critical. He's explicitly saying there that there will be Y people in the world who will not have a truck, who will not have a PC. Right? He's really calling that out. He's saying they'll still be there, they'll still be good for some uses, but they will not be, you know, owned by everybody who needs motor transport. And of course, that's the way it worked out with trucks. But let me remind you what Phil Schiller said. He said, it's a world where you're going to have a phone, a tablet, a computer. You don't have to choose. So which is it? Is it Steve Jobs in 2010 saying the number, you know, one out of X people will have a PC? Phil Schiller saying you will have a PC. You see why this Mac 30 interview is starting to sort of bother me a little bit?
I mean, let's change the product categories and imagine if we were talking about the iPhone and the iPod and we had Phil Schiller doing a retrospective of 10 years of the iPod or 15 years of the iPod and talking about how great it was and how it's still, you know, a great tool for this and a great tool for that, and says we're going to live in a world where you have your iPhone and your iPod.
You don't have to choose.
You don't have to choose. And we would all say, well, right, I'm not choosing. I'm choosing my iPhone. I don't need the iPod. And again, I'm not trying to discount the Mac in any way, because it's still a fantastic device. Mm-hmm. But I think Steve was always kind of famous for talking about on the analyst calls about, you know, that the iPhone was cannibalizing the iPod. And your products are always going to be cannibalized by something. You just want to make sure it's the products you're creating after it.
Yep.
And so if Apple, and to me, the fear here is by living in a world where you think that the Mac will always be around, do you let your quote unquote tablet and mobile OS kind of falter a little bit by trying to protect the Mac? Because to me, the Steve vision was, we'll still have the Mac. Sure, there will be people that need the Mac, but that we're going to drive forward our vision of the future where your devices are all kind of the same. You know, and again, it's like, it'd be like saying that Ford, saying that everybody's always going to need trucks. And, you know, the truck will always be around. And we would say, but this car, I like this car that has, yeah, it can't haul everything I need it to be, but I don't need that. It has distinct advantages over the truck that make it a better device or a better automobile for me.
Yeah, I think in some ways what you're sort of saying is, you know, we make a lot of trucks. People like trucks. Trucks have got a great flatbed on the back for carrying a huge big load, so we're not putting a trunk on the car. If you need a trunk, get a truck. See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what it feels like to me. But anyway, let me move on a little bit more, because there's still one more year to go of Steve's life. And what happens in 2011, if you remember WWDC of that year, iCloud and iOS 5 come out. And at this point in Steve's life, many other Apple executives are taking the stage in order to give parts of the message, if you like. But of course, Steve's hand is still very much on the company at this point. And I was, when I was doing a bit of research for this show, I came across Scott Forstall introducing the tentpole features of iOS 5 during WWDC 2011. And he says, I'm going to quote this. In fact, why don't I let him speak for himself? Run the clip here.
Number 8. PC free. So we've built these incredible devices, the iPhone and the iPad, and people get them home, they open up their box, and they see this. Uh-huh. I say, what? You know, we're living in a post-PC world. In fact, especially with the iPad, we're ushering in the post-PC world. And we have a lot of customers coming to us and saying, I want to buy an iPad as my only device. I don't own a computer. I want to buy an iPhone as my only device, my only actually internet access for where I live. Will be my iPhone. We know we're selling into a lot of places where the households just don't have computers. And they want to buy an iOS device as their only device, and that's exactly what we're going to support in iOS 5. Now, when you take your iPhone out of the box, instead of seeing this, you're going to see this. You can now set up and activate your device right on the device, and you are ready to go. It's that easy. And of course, there's some other things we had to do to make this possible. Software updates are now over the air. So you no longer need to go and plug into a computer just to update your software. And of course, they're now Delta updates. So instead of downloading the entire OS, you just download what's changed. Now, the next thing we did is we looked at all of the apps on the iPhone, iPad, iPod Touch, and asked ourselves, what are the reasons that people go back to a computer today? And let's add that functionality right to iOS. So for instance, you used to have to go back to a computer to create calendars or delete calendars. You can now create and delete calendars right from iOS. You saw for photos, we've added really significant editing functionality in there. So you can crop, rotate, one-tap enhance, red-eye reduction right from within your iOS device. And even in mail now, you can create mailboxes and delete mailboxes right from iOS. So we looked at all the apps on the iPhone and the iPad, added that functionality, so now if you want to cut the cord, you can.
Do you see what he said in that clip? He says, we're living in a post-PC world. We have a lot of customers coming to us and saying, I want to buy an iPad as my only device. I don't want to own a computer. I want to own an iPhone as my only internet access device. And what you can't see because it's a podcast, but at that point, he shows a slide of the number of households in various countries that don't have a computer. And interestingly, China is a gigantic first step because many, many households in China don't have a computer of any kind. Of course, think about it as of today. Where's Apple's next big wave of growth coming from? China. It's a country with the most people who don't have a computer in their house. China, right? So I thought that was very interesting as well. Like, Forstall, as we sort of know, was the protege of Jobs. He was one of the people who were said to be closest to Jobs. And there he is on stage in 2011, driving forward that post-PC, declaring the post-PC era, claiming it for Apple, and saying that there will be Apple customers who don't want to have a desktop computer or a laptop for that matter. I thought that was, you know, that just jumped out at me when I was watching that video in preparation for the show.
Well, and it reminds me of when Steve was introducing iCloud that year and said that he kind of worked backwards and talked about the digital hub strategy and talked about how syncing this stuff was, you know, driving us nuts. You know, you take a photo here and you sync it there, but it's not on the iPad. And he's, I think his term was, this stuff's driving us nuts. Yeah. And so he made it, he kind of redid the slide, and the Mac was no longer the center, but it was just a player in the game. And, yeah, and iCloud was the center, and iOS and the Mac they were equal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because what's happening there is he's essentially announcing the death of the digital hub strategy. Because he's saying, look, we had this digital hub thing, the Mac was at the center, now it's driving us nuts syncing all this stuff. Like, we're overloading the sync system, if you like, and what we're going to do is we're going to push the Mac down to be one client amongst equals of the cloud. Of course, that's why cloud computing, regardless of whether it comes from Apple or Google, is so important right now, is because we all have these multiple devices. And that's one conception of the world, and I think that's okay. I think that's a decent conception of the world. Multiple clients, all synchronized through the cloud. It's a pretty decent world. That's the world we live in, and it's not bad.
No, it's, I mean, if you'd have told me, you know, if I could go back and be in college now with things like Evernote and Dropbox and Google Drive.
Oh, yeah.
You're thinking, living in the future. I mean, we were using thumb drives, and that was even for me. You know, I was in college in 2002, 2003. Had a 128 meg thumb drive, and that was living in the future. And then now you can literally, like, I mean, you could, worst case, if you had a lecture class, your buddy could go in there and turn on FaceTime audio and you could not even come.
Every student's dream.
Oh, yeah. And so it's, you know, it reminds me, I had a tweet a little while ago, or a few days ago, and said, if I could ask one question to an Apple executive, it would be, what is someone with a 64 gigabyte iPhone that fills it up with their camera roll, how are they supposed to back it up? And then I followed that up with, the only logical explanation is to get a Mac. And looking back at that article, that would probably be their answer. But mm-hmm. I think Steve's answer would have been, we need to work on that. And I don't know that that would be somebody, you know, that if you were to ask Johnny Ive or Tim Cook or Phil Schiller, they would say, you should get those on a Mac.
Yeah. And you wonder where all that goes. Right? Are we going to say to these people in China who buy their first Apple product and it's an iPhone or an iPad mini, oh, you filled it up, time to spend, you know, 3 months' wages on a Mac? Is that what we're saying? I'm not sure. So the last point I wanted to make in this whole kind of argument is Steve Jobs famously told people that they didn't want things and then later came out with them, right? So this is the counterpoint to my argument that Jobs was always open and honest and remarkably consistent and never deviated from stated strategies. But there is a distinction to be made here between the things that he said nobody wanted and then later did, and what he said they were going to do and what they actually did. Does that distinction make sense?
Yes.
So the way I describe it is that what Jobs, let's say, misled people about a little bit was whether or not a particular product fit a particular market at a particular time. So, I mean, let's name them, right? He said, nobody wants to watch video on a tiny screen. And then a year or so later, out comes the video-capable iPod, the fifth-generation iPod, right? Which was clearly not, you know, people did want to watch video on a small screen because they wanted to take it with them. But I guess the point being that Apple didn't have one ready at the time, so therefore it was worthwhile seeing that it didn't suit. Similarly, he famously said on one of the analyst calls, he said, these small tablets, nobody wants them. People want a full-size tablet. They want an iPad. You know, a couple of years later, out comes the iPad mini. He also said that about, if you want to go back further in time, he said when the iMac G4 came out, do you remember the one with the kind of half football and the gooseneck and the vertical display? Mm-hmm. He said it was a great idea to take a flat screen, stick all a computer on the back, and then make that your flat screen iMac. No, we're going to do this other thing. And then, of course, the next generation, the iMac G5, guess what it was? A flat screen panel with a computer stuck on the back. Right. So there were various things like that. And, of course, the most, maybe not the most famous one, but another one that he said was, it doesn't matter how good the product is, referring to the Kindle, nobody reads books anymore. And then a few years later, out comes the iPad, out comes the iBook Store. Suddenly Apple's number two reseller of books, electronic books. But in all those cases, right? In all those cases, what he's saying there is, you people don't want this product you think you want, right? He's telling people something about what they should think about what they want. He's essentially trying to shape demand, and he's talking about product and market fit. Whereas he never said, oh, we're going to do this thing, and then they go and do something else. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and he's really, and he's always, you know, one of the ones that I can remember us talking about the video iPod. He doesn't go into, like, go into reasons why, like, say, Apple couldn't do it, for example. Like he did with, like, say, the netbook, talking about it couldn't make a cheap laptop.
Yeah.
In some ways, he's saying the current products that are out now, they stink, and here's why. And he's, like, almost like, there's almost like a comma, and he doesn't finish the sentence. But if and when Apple does it, we'll do this, and you'll love it.
Yes, exactly. So in those cases, I think it was sort of a timing question, maybe. You know, he's trying to hold off people from wanting something before they want, before Apple's ready to give it to them, you know? Which I guess is the cut and thrust of marketing, I suppose. But what he never did is he never said, hey, guess what, we're going to adopt, you know, this OS strategy, and then we change it and do this one. I mean, there was a slight change in the Rhapsody strategy, but that was 2001, and that was a very different Apple from the Apple of today. He never said, we're going to do a digital hub strategy, and then, oh, suddenly we're doing this other thing. Digital hub absolutely ran its course until it could no longer be sustained under the weight of the data that we were transferring through that hub, and it had to move to the cloud.
Yeah, you know, in the Q&A section of D10, and you know, people were talking about, one of the questions was about the problems of syncing devices. And, you know, you can, I've got all this media on my computer and I want it to easily get to my, you know, iPad and my iPhone. And you know, he kind of corrects the person and says, no, you can buy all your media directly on those devices. It just, you can, you know, has the full iTunes store. And he said, what you're wanting is to share your content amongst all your devices. And they said, oh, yeah, that's what we want. And he says, you can do that today with a wire. But what you want to do is do it without a wire. And the guy said, yeah. He goes, well, we need to work on that. And obviously, you know, that was about a year before iCloud came out. And that was, he was setting, you know, he was kind of vision casting there for the future. And they kind of, you know, went forth with that strategy, you know, for better or worse. We can talk about the implementation. But, you know, I bought a TV show for my son last night on my phone. And then he was able to, you know, access it from an Apple TV. Yeah, that's what the guy was asking for, and that's the vision that Steve set, and that's what we have now.
Yeah, and I think that's another case of strategy, you know, coming along at the right time. So the question remains, why in 2014 does an Apple executive come out and say, you're going to have a phone, a tablet, and a computer? You don't have to choose. You're not going to be one thing or the other. Because the way I, putting together all of those Jobs quotes and the messaging they gave from iPhone to iPad to iCloud, iOS 5, all that kind of stuff, the way I always saw this working out was that iOS, yes, in 2010 on iPad, was weaker than the Mac. And I think over the first 3 years, as we were using the iPad in school, the fundamental story of those 3 years was the iPad gets more and more and more powerful, but at the same time, iOS got more and more and more capable. But I'm starting to feel like that hit the buffers. And I'll tell you when it hit the buffers was iOS 6. Because iOS 5 was a massive, massive upgrade in terms of it changed our very conception of what an iOS device could be. Right? It took us from being a device that was an adjunct to a Mac, dependent on a Mac for activation, dependent on a Mac for so many things, to being a standalone computer that you could walk out the Apple Store, turn it on, set it up, and you're up and running on a computer. Right? There are still things today, and we're getting now to things like backing up a 64 gig iPhone, where you still need a Mac. And Scott Forstall got up on stage, I referred to this earlier, he got up on stage during the iOS 5 transition, and he said, we asked ourselves, why do our customers have to go back to the Mac to achieve certain tasks? We went through iOS and we fixed them all. And he gives examples like creating a new calendar in the calendar app, which you used to have to do on your Mac and then sync it to your phone. He gave the example of making a new mailbox in Mail, which you used to have to do in your Mac and sync it to your iPhone through IMAP. Those things were added to iOS, so iOS got far more powerful and far more standalone than it ever had been in previous times. Okay? So why, again, the question, why is it now that you're going to have one of each? Now, let me throw this out there, Bradley. It's possible that what they're saying is not true, right? That the vision is not actually you're going to have all these three. But what they're saying is, well, for now, because we haven't got to whatever we need to get to, let's just say we're going to have all three devices and the cloud's going to tie it all together. That's one possibility, right? That they are trying to do a Steve Jobs with the nobody reads anymore story, and they're saying this is the strategy and there will be another strategy along in a little while. Does that seem like the reason? I'm not sure.
I think we'll know a lot when we see iOS 8 and iOS 9.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you can say, okay, iOS 6. Yeah, you know, not a lot. You didn't drive the OS forward, having to play catch up on the maps, and you know, there's some other things, and you know, we kind of played our, you know, put a lot of work into Siri, and that's gone okay. Mm-hmm. Then they say, okay, forestalls out. iOS 7, radical redesign, functionally pretty much the same, and we got some new, obviously some new APIs, but also you got Control Center. But again, it's a largely a visual change. Mm-hmm. So with iOS 8 and iOS 9, do we see the vision for the next 7-8 years of iOS and maybe the next, you know, the future of Apple?
To me, iOS 8 is a crucial release because I think if iOS 8 doesn't bring more quote-unquote pro features, right? And by which I mean features, let me get this straight. If iOS doesn't dramatically reduce my dependence on a Mac by another order of magnitude, then I think I'm starting to question where this whole thing is going. That's my take on what iOS 8 means to me.
Yeah, I mean, but, it's I'm in some ways scared for iOS 8.
Yeah.
Because
it could be a massive disappointment.
I would love to not have a computer at my house, like a traditional Mac. I would love for our only, you know, electronic devices to be a couple iPads, a couple iPhones, and maybe one Bluetooth keyboard if we need to write something long form and that maybe is more comfortable with a hardware keyboard. Sure.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I want. That's my vision of computing. My photos aren't stored at my house. You know, I don't have to deal with any of that. I want these devices that are always on, incredible battery life, just extremely portable. And you know, in a perfect world, I would have an iPhone style device that could somehow expand to be an iPad, then maybe expand to be a 13-inch device. Like that's obviously like a perfect world for me, with an OS that does everything, that you don't have to go back to the Mac for anything. Because mm-hmm. I don't want to go back to the Mac. And again, love my Mac. Great device. Greatest computer I've ever owned. You know, in terms of like a traditional laptop. Mm-hmm. I want to work on iOS. Not to say that I can, but because of what it allows me to do portability-wise. I had an article here recently about how, you know, one of the things I do for work is I have to take a video that's 2 gigabytes every week and convert it to an audio clip for a podcast. And I've had these workflows where I could figure out how to do it from iOS. Well, I figured out through this service called Cloud Convert that I can actually do it from the cloud, not even have to download that file locally even to my iPad or my iPhone. I can literally, and I'm pretty sure Cloud Convert must be running on Amazon S3 because it can pull the file from Dropbox in a couple minutes. And it's 2 gigabytes. And it, you know, it all happened. I can do the whole thing in about 10 minutes, you know, including uploading the podcast, writing up show notes. It's very quickly. That's the world I want to live in. So I can literally do it from my phone, sitting at a red light if I need to. Mm-hmm. That's my vision of computing.
Yeah. And when I think about this article, this Mac 30 interview, it sort of presupposes that the only way in which iOS could get more powerful is to be more like the Mac, or somehow to converge the two. So like the Windows 8 strategy, I'm not sold on that either. The idea that there's one operating system for both my desktop computer and my tablet. What I actually want is I want my tablet to be so powerful that I don't want to think about a desktop computer. And it's the problem in a lot of these articles about post-PC and iOS Pro or whatever is that a lot of people writing can't conceive of how iOS could actually eclipse a Mac in terms of functionality. I can certainly see that world, but a lot of people don't seem to get that into their head. So again, the question, why? What has happened here? What does this interview actually mean? What does it actually signify in terms of Apple's strategy? Is it just a throwaway rah-rah for the Mac thing and we'll just keep doing the post-PC stuff in the background? Possibly it's that, but I don't think people like Phil Schiller are that careless with their words. So there's two options, right? Either they're being honest and this is the strategy, or they're trying to pull a Steve Jobs. Now, if they're trying to pull a Steve Jobs talking about video iPods, then I guess, you know, what does that tell us about the strategy? I suppose it tells us either that whatever the post-PC strategy is either still quite immature and a way off, or it's not very strong and it could easily be copied, or it's actually unpalatable to people right now and they don't want to frighten everybody. I'm not sure which is, but I guess, you know, perhaps what this indicates is, you know, is iOS 8 going to be as powerful as we think it is? Or are they going to, you know, is there going to be another life cycle of having a Mac and an iPad and an iPhone before we finally get to iOS 9, iOS 10, whatever, where that's the one where we finally see, okay, I'm not actually going to buy another Mac again.
Yeah.
In some ways, that's the optimistic scenario, that they are actually trying to keep everybody going for a little while before they actually show us the next phase of post-PC. That's the optimistic scenario. The pessimistic scenario for fans of post-PC like myself and like you, Bradley, is that they're actually being honest. What Phil Schiller says is what the strategy actually now is, which is that post-PC is dead, Steve's vision is out, Forstall's out the company. I mean, he was in many ways the torchbearer for post-PC, and he's gone. And in fact, some of the sort of comments that were made in the Mavericks demos sort of suggested that the people who are now in charge didn't really like Scott Forstall very much at all. I don't know if you remember that, some of the, you know, the, oh, we ran out of green felt and there's no stitching on the calendar, blah, 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 and getting a good laugh at the expense of the UI design that Forstall was most associated with. But this is, if they're being honest, if we are to take these words at face value, this is a massive reversal in strategy, isn't it?
You know, I guess for me, you just wonder, if we had the internet back when Steve was let go at Apple, mm-hmm. would people have been cheering it in such the same way that a lot of the Mac community was you know, kicking Forstall out the door?
Mm.
And if so, would we welcome, I mean, 10 years from now, let's say the Mac is, you know, still around, still doing its thing, but Apple as a whole is kind of stagnated and someone else has kind of caught up with them and passed them as the premium brand. And if Forstall came back, would we welcome him back like, you know, the return of the king?
That's a pretty solid question to ask, isn't it?
You know, the new Apple ad that was released, it was, again, this may not mean anything, but it was shot on an iPhone. And everyone's talking about that. That's, oh, it's amazing. It's shot on an iPhone. But it was edited on a Mac.
Mm-hmm. And they make a big play of that as well in the sort of behind the scenes. You know, here's a room stuffed full of Macs, and we sent these devices out into the field. So in many ways, you know, I think it was Rennie Ritchie from iMore, he sort of put it out there and said, this advert shows Apple passing the baton from the Mac to the iPhone. I don't think it shows anything of the kind. I think it actually reinforces the strategy they're showing, which is, or the strategy they said to Macworld, which is, these mobile devices go out in the field, but you've got to bring it back to the Mac for the quote-unquote real work. That makes me uneasy. It really does. Because you know who doesn't have a legacy desktop division to look after? Google.
Yeah. And Samsung, you know, they can that them together, you know, it's a post PC only world,
mm-hmm.
and you know they live. You know, Google has an OS, It's the internet.
We've got two. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's the internet. You know, the Google, yeah. Google is building. They build tools around the internet. So you even think mm-hmm. about their new products, like the thermostat they own, the Nest. All of it is the center is the internet. There is no legacy hardware and software to deal with. And so if Google wants to do something like this ad, they're going to talk about how it was done completely on an Android device from start to finish.
Yep. And that's critical, right? The world is going mobile first. I mean, just look at Apple's own numbers. 51 million iPhones, 26 million iPads, 4 million Macs. And yet we're to believe that we've got to buy one of each of those? How many customers must Apple have who are iPhone customers who are not Mac customers? People who are iPhone and iPad customers who are not Mac customers. And is the game to try and convert all of them into Mac customers as well? Or couldn't we build a world where they don't have to be Mac customers at all? We're kind of one foot in both of those worlds right now. And I'd really like to know where this is all going to go. Silence.
Yeah.
It's an open question, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, I think.
You know, what does. You know, the question to me is not what does the future hold? Because no one ultimately knows that. We can make guesses.
Yeah.
But the question is, what does Apple think the future holds?
Yes, because the point being that Apple has the power to make whatever future they want to come true. Right? It's not just that the future will happen and it will be done to Apple. The key, if you look back at all these things we've talked about that Steve Jobs did, he made them up and he made them happen. He turned Apple to those ends to make them happen. So he, you know, made Apple get the internet. He made Apple, you know, build OS X up to be the powerhouse that it is. He made Apple build the digital hub suite, iLife and iWork and so on. He made them, you know, break ground on a data center in North Carolina before the iPhone even shipped, because he knew one day they were going to need that kind of facility. You know, he had the opportunity to build the iPad. He built the phone first, then he built the iPad. And then he saw that the digital hub was starting to crumble under the weight and built iCloud and iOS 5. And he saw, along with Forstall, that one day there was going to be people who bought an iPhone who never bought a Mac. And he made all that happen. And the question, you're absolutely right, Bradley. That's a brilliant point just to wrap up on, is what does Apple think the future is going to be? Because Apple is one of the few companies in technology who can make the future whatever they want it to be. And the question is, what do they want it to be?
And they control, you know, the entire piece. You know, they can make the entire car. They're not, you know, we often say that Google, you know, Google is like, you know, somebody that makes engines. They don't make you know, they don't make the entire thing. Well, Apple makes the entire thing. Mm-hmm. And so they have so much more control over the future of computing than any one company around today. And I think if we look ahead 10 years from now and we see Apple has faltered, is not the innovative company, the dominant company, and a company focused on, you know, kind of the future, I think we can look back at this and say the Mac was, you're not necessarily the software, but the entire idea of the Mac was like, it's like what happened to Windows with, or Microsoft with Windows, that they were so beholden to Windows that they couldn't see the future. And maybe if they could see the future, it scared them too much. And I don't think with Apple, it's necessarily about protecting the profits of the Mac, because iOS is drastically a more profitable platform, from the hardware that goes around it to the, you know, the application ecosystem, which they completely own and dominate. So what are they holding on to? If the future does require a Mac in Apple's vision, why are they holding on to it?
Absolutely. And I don't feel that what we're seeing tonight, Bradley, is, I don't think this, I'm not saying this is like the end of my interest in iPad. Absolutely not. I'm not saying this is the end of my interest in Apple. But it almost feels like we're putting a time capsule down here. And I think it'll be interesting in a year, 2 years, to come back to this episode and see whether or not we were being unduly pessimistic or not pessimistic enough.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not I think Apple makes incredible products. I am not planning on buying any sort of Android-based device anytime soon. But to me, this is one of the first times in recent memory that I can say, maybe here's a red flag. Not saying that we've got a problem, but maybe we just put a marker right here and use this, you know, this interview, what we understand, you know, about what's happened with iOS in the past few years. And we look to the future and every decision Apple does from here on out through kind of that lens and see how that lines up. Are we still driving post-PC forward? Are we still kind of saying, I mean, because in some ways, it's still the digital hub strategy. Because, yeah, we've got the cloud as an extra part of it, but you still have got the Mac where the real data is. And that's not the vision that Steve laid out.
No, it's not. No, it's a repudiation of so many parts of that. You know, 2011 was the cloud is the hub. The Mac is but one client. Yet today, here we are, back in a world where for some things, and it's not just that for some bits of your life on your iPad, you have to connect it back to a Mac, but it's that for some parts of your computing life, you have to use a Mac to achieve those ends. Do you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. There's a slight difference there. It's not that you don't need a Mac to make your iPad work anymore, but you need an iMac to make you work. Right? You need a MacBook Pro or whatever to achieve all the things you want to achieve with a computer. Yeah. And I think the point being, you know, to go back to cars versus trucks, it's not that you have to be a particularly advanced computer user to need a Mac, right? Now, I could understand a world where, yeah, the people who are buying a Mac Pro definitely need a Mac Pro, right? High-end professionals, people building software, you know, making movies, doing all that stuff. Sure, they're going to need a Mac. They're people, they're farmers, right? But the problem is that, you know, people who've got a house still need a truck so far because the cars haven't been built out to to satisfy all of their requirements. I mean, I've never owned a pickup truck. Probably never will. But that's because all the cars I can buy satisfy all of my needs. I don't need to buy a pickup truck.
Yeah, I've had one before. There are times right now I wish I had one. But not enough to get one yet. You know, in some ways, I'd like the ability to rent one periodically to haul things. But so I'm in some ways there with my Mac that mm-hmm. I just don't. You know, there are a lot of things I do not at home, not with a laptop with me. That it's just, you know, I don't want to be tethered back to a machine. I want to be able to do it from any device I have, and for that to be the case. Apple's vision has to be, every iOS release, it has to be, okay, what is left that we are still forcing users to use a Mac only for? Not that we are trying to make the Mac weaker and to make it where you have to use iOS for something, but to eliminate, you know, it's like if they've got a to-do list, and it's like, what, you know, go through our to-do list of what we said, you know, in the beginning of this discussion of what still requires a Mac. Let's figure that out. And so you begin to eliminate those things. That, in some ways, there's your iOS strategy. That's the future of iOS, are the things that still require a Mac.
Yeah, and eventually you'll get to the point where it's things like running Xcode. Yeah. Can we fix that? That may be 5 years off. That's fine, right? Running Final Cut Pro, editing 4K video footage, whatever. Those things can be at the end of the to-do list, but you've got to start with things like, I want to upload a file to a website. Which is something normal people do, right? You know, I want to open a PDF in PDF Expert from Evernote. Something normal people do, right? Those are not high-end tasks, but they're still tasks that are stymied by some of the design decisions in iOS. And I think iOS 8 is a real litmus test for Apple as to whether or not we can take Phil Schiller at his word today or whether he was stringing us along until they blew our minds with iOS 8 and iOS 9. I sure hope he's stringing me along, but I'm just slightly concerned that he's actually telling me the truth. And I'm not sure that's what I wanted. Time will tell.
Yes.
Shall we leave it there, Bradley?
I think so.
We could go around and around this forever, and it would be good fun to do so, but I think the point is the ball is very much in Apple's court as to what they do next. If iOS 8 comes out, and it has all these new plumbing, new features, new workflows that you can do, I'm going to be the happiest guy in the world. But if it comes out and it's, you know, a tweak here, a tweak there, a new app, a health monitoring app, is that really where this is all going? I'm not so sure. So anyway, let us cheer up a little bit right at the end. Happy memories, I suppose, but a little bit concerning towards the end there. A red flag, I think, as you say, is probably the best way to put it. Anyway, for more of this, where can people find us on the internet?
I am on the web at chambersdaily.com, and I'm on Twitter at Bradley Chambers.
And I'm on the web at spears.org, Fraser Spears on Twitter, and we'll talk to you all next week.
Have a good week.